Welcome to the OMFIR podcast.
This is Mark Sobel, U.S. Chair of OMFIF. Today, I'm delighted to be joined to host Randy Quarles, who recently served as member of the Federal Reserve Board, the Vice Chair for Supervision, and also the Chair of the Financial Stability Board. Randy has had a distinguished career in private sector as a securities and bank merger lawyer and in private equity, plus a long distinguished career in public service, even before joining the Fed, serving at the Treasury, including as Assistant Secretary for International Affairs and Undersecretary for Domestic Finance. I had the great honor of serving under Randy, whereas he got stuck with the challenge of putting up with me. He's one of my favorite all-time bosses. As a policymaker, he applied his prodigious intellect into digging into details, understanding technical details, listening and working closely with staff, and thinking deeply about issues to come up with pragmatic solutions. So in short, he pursued the optimal approach to policymaking, whether you agreed with where he came out or not. In addition, Randy is one of the genuinely kindest and warmest individuals one could ever wish to meet. I plan to pose a number of questions regarding financial, regulatory, and stability issues for up to the first half of the discussion, and then I'll be joined by Don Cohn and Trish Moss, sir, to kick off the discussion, followed by some lead-off questioners. The audience can submit questions via the chat function. So welcome, Randy. And since you're out of office, we're expecting no holds barred today. So you served as the first official vice chair for supervision. Banks are seen as having well-weathered the storm of the pandemic. But some say that your efforts to recalibrate and tailor, to use your terms, aspects of Dodd-Frank gutted the legislation. You were even called dangerous. I defended you on Twitter from that allegation. What were your key accomplishments at the Fed? And without giving an epic response to critics, delving into numerators and denominators of ratios and the like, what's your response to the critics?
Thanks for that very, very warm introduction. I'm going to find a clip of this and play it for my wife when she reminds me that I've once again forgotten that they come to pick up the garbage on Thursday rather than Friday. But so let me try to make a relatively condensed response to that. So on the day I left the Fed, the effective required capital for the largest banks in the system, the banks that we run the stress test on, it's about the 33 top banks, was actually higher than the day I arrived. And that was precisely as a result of some of the technical changes we made to the stress test. That's the required capital. The actual capital levels of the largest banks in the system, the G-SIBs, so that's the capital that they keep as a management buffer above our requirements. It was mildly higher than on the day I arrived. And for the large non-G-SIBs, it was materially higher than on the day I arrived. And as you noted, most importantly, the banking system faced the largest shock in its history in March of 2020. The whole real economy closed down. That extended through the summer, and it weathered it with flying colors. They added $100 billion to their loan loss reserves. They actually raised the amount of capital that they maintained, all while continuing to pay dividends throughout the COVID event when most of the rest of the world's banks had to suspend them. And now, in response to that, some people say, well, that doesn't really count because of the amount of fiscal and Fed support that bailed out the real economy and prevented a lot of the potential losses from rolling up into the financial sector. But that ignores the fact that during the year from the spring of 2020 through the spring of 2021, we ran seven stress tests on the banking system, each of them assuming that there would be no additional support. And that there would be swinging losses, taking into account the evolution of the position of the banking system during that time. And they passed all of them. The system passed all of them. So the system that absorbed the COVID shock, which was the system after all the changes that I made, was a very healthy system. monetary system. So then the second part of this, and I'll try to condense this part too, is you might say, well, then from the other side, and there were criticisms from the other side as well, which is, well, you were appointed to reduce regulatory burden, and it sounds like you just increased the burden. So what did you do if capital levels were actually higher at the end of your tenure than when you began? So what we did was we made the system materially more efficient and transparent. So just as an example, the stress test changes that I referred to, they increased the average required capital, given the changes that they made, but they reduced the uncertainty around those capital requirements. So banks were able, before COVID, and they beefed themselves up during COVID, and they had the capacity to do that, but they were able to reduce the management buffers that they kept above those increased required minimums. Now, in my view, we should be close to indifferent as to what supererogatory buffers management chooses to keep above our minimums. If we think our minimums are too low, we should raise them. We shouldn't make the rules so opaque that banks have to keep a bunch of excess capital above what we really think is necessary. And the analogy that I often use, it's a little homely, but I think it's accurate. We could take down all the speed limit signs on the highway. And we could say to folks, well, there is a speed limit, but we're not going to tell you what it is. And moreover, it will change from day to day. But if you exceed it, the penalty will be mandatory public humiliation and jail. That essentially was the stress test framework that we lived in before I arrived at the Fed. And in that world, people will certainly travel more slowly than they do now. They will almost certainly travel more slowly than we really think is a solidly safe speed. So that system would work in the sense of limiting average speed, but it reduces the efficient movement of vehicles from A to B. It's not at all necessary to make the highways safe. And it's just not a way for a government to behave. We should put in the intellectual work to determine what we think is a set speed. We should, a safe speed. We should set a clear limit and we should enforce it. And that's what we did. Slightly different emphasis on the Volcker Rule. The Volcker Rule in 2017 was incomprehensible. It was completely impenetrable by both the regulators and the regulated. A great deal rested on the discretionary judgment of examiners trying to implement a rule of staggering complexity with unclear interpretations and a rule that can't be understood, can't be complied with. We didn't gut the Volcker Rule. We simplified and clarified its operation. And as a result, we have fewer questions internally from examiners about how they're supposed to apply it. We have much clearer compliance from the banking industry. So I could go on for hours. Nobody wants me to do that. But the basic point, as I said at the very outset of my tenure, we have a public interest, not only in the safety and soundness of our financial system, but in its efficiency, because a more efficient system means more support for the real economy. That means more jobs, more growth, higher living standards for everyone. So we should ensure that regulation not only keeps the system safe, and obviously the changes that we made did that given the performance of the banking system during COVID, but that our system is also simple, efficient, and transparent, and that drove everything we did. I think it was a material improvement. It was a material reduction in burden, but as the evidence I cited at the outset showed, it did not make the system weaker. It actually made it stronger.
Okay. Well, thank you for that. I'm sure history will have much to debate there, but it's good to get you on the record. Another general topic, low interest rates promote a search for yield. Financial stability isn't part of the dual mandate. Asset prices seem elevated. Whatever's going on in Wall Street today. And there's always a risk for major repricing when asset valuations are stretched. One wishes to separate monetary policy from financial stability concerns. That requires sound banking supervision, but a robust macroprudential framework. How feasible is separation of micro and macroprudential policy from monetary policy? And does the Fed have it right in thinking about the role financial stability plays in its decision-making processes?
So on that complex of topics, I'm really in large agreement with, I guess what you'd say is the received wisdom, certainly the official position of the Fed for a long period of time, which is that really the you can't or shouldn't calibrate monetary policy in light of financial stability concerns, and that really the most effective way and the way with the least unintended consequences of addressing the financial stability risks that arise during boom times, when there are separate reasons for setting monetary policy in a more accommodative fashion, is macroprudential policy, is the regulation of the financial system. So I do think that's possible. There are some weaknesses in our current framework, because, the Federal Reserve, which has the principal responsibility for financial stability of the system, really only has the strongest levers, of regulation on the banking system. And the banking system is a smaller and smaller part of the overall, financial system. I think if one thinks, you know, comprehensively and over a long period of time about how the regulatory system ought to evolve, I think we clearly ought to address the limited macroprudential regulation we have of the non-bank financial sector currently. But that's the way we ought to be moving, rather than sort of, again, calibrating monetary policy expressly in light of potential financial stability risks. That's the official position of the Fed, generally the received wisdom at the Fed and more broadly, not universal. Jeremy Stein famously said, you know, monetary policy gets in all the cracks. Maybe we should be using it as a tool to address some of these financial stability issues because it is so pervasive, and our current regulatory system is limited and really most effective with regard to the banks. But I think the answer to that is to address regulation and not to start being more expansive with the objectives of monetary policy.
Well, thank you. Let me drill down a little bit on that question and see if we can be a little more controversial. Mario Draghi said the euro was like a bumblebee, a mystery of nature, because it shouldn't fly, but instead it does. So that made me think of the U.S. financial regulatory structure, though I really shouldn't insult the aerodynamic qualities of bumblebees. So the Fed oversees banks. It doesn't oversee non-banks, as you said. Those are in the realm of the SEC, the CFTC, and the FSOC. Non-banks were at the center of the pandemic storm, GFC as well. And if their overseers don't get the job, that's going to affect your ability to get the Fed's ability to secure its dual mandate. The SEC lacks a financial stability mandate, something Don Cohn has pointed out very frequently. The FSOC is a very big grouping, and most would say it has been somewhat dormant. So what kind of improvements and changes are needed in the FSOC and those overseeing non-bank financial intermediation? And are there other improvements that can feasibly be achieved in the U.S. regulatory structure, recognizing that our politics precludes many basic and sensible, reasonable reforms?
Yeah. So earlier in my career, I had grand ambitions for how we might really be able to kind of rationalize the U.S. regulatory system. And I guess with age and many scars, I begin where you concluded that question, which is, you know, our politics and the nature of the universe really won't allow us to get to an intellectually pleasing system. It will always be this historical kaleidoscope. So what do you do in light of that? You have to have a better coordinating mechanism than we have. The FSOC was intended to provide that coordinating mechanism. I think it was well intended, but it's A, just too big to really sort of serve as an effective mechanism to help coordinate the regulatory process in the United States. It's not just that it's just too big. It has a lot of the wrong people at the table. It has all the right people at the table for the most part, but it also has a lot of other folks that make it sort of feel the wrong place to have some of these discussions. So in the Trump administration, the Treasury basically reinvigorated the president's working group and added the other bank regulators in an ad hoc fashion to that small president's working group structure. And in at least in its first year, the Biden Treasury, the Yellen Treasury, was moving along those lines as well. I think that's a more promising framework for actually having a coordinating mechanism that can result in honest discussions and some genuine coordination, as opposed to kind of Potemkin village speech making. And I think that it has been reasonably effective. It could be even more effective. I don't know if that would require kind of legislation to put some more teeth into the president's working group. I mean, the last time we had a legislative project to try to improve the coordinating mechanism, we came up with the FSOC, which I think is kind of a bust. But I think that's the most promising avenue for future coordination.
And I recall that when you were at Treasury, you also at that time were a proponent of the PWG.
That was one of my objectives, was a more athletic PWG, I think. And what we got was the FSOC. And I still think that the right mechanism is a more athletic PWG. You don't necessarily need legislation. You need kind of a Treasury secretary, with the will to do it, which actually I think Yellen is definitely moving in that direction. And you need to have appointed people to the key PWG agencies who understand that that is part of their job, is to participate in this coordination, and not, as you taught me and as I often have quoted, Mark, but you taught me, I think in our first year together at the Treasury, that coordination is what you do to the other guy. And that attitude obviously still abounds too much, even in the PWG process. So you need to have, future administrations need to think about the need for coordination and not just the need for the right person in a, for a particular agency, but the right person for a coordinating process.
Well, now that I'm out of government, I'm a kind and sharing guy these days. So when you were at Treasury and all of your colleagues would roll their eyes when they heard Financial Stability Forum, the forerunner of the Financial Stability Board, you were the one person who would get all giddy with excitement. The FSB, for me, is one of the most important and least known international fora. After the global crisis, it really played a vital role in strengthening the international financial regulatory agenda and cooperation. I felt that by using kind of the G20 process to provide kind of light guidance and communiques to the international regulatory community, the standard setters kind of managed through the FSB, that we were able to facilitate getting some important changes made and improve global governance in this terrain. So you chaired the FSB. Do you agree that it's really an unsung but vitally important organization? And what did you accomplish as the FSB chair, and what does it need to do more on? And as you know, I've really advocated a much more forceful FSB push on NBFI, which I think your pursuit was being pursued.
Yeah. So I would agree with that. I think that the FSB has definitely proven its value twice. now in extremely stressful circumstances, in kind of coordinating and providing the right level of impetus to changes that were particularly effective for the banking system in the aftermath of the 2008-2009 crisis. And then during COVID, it really has been underreported and therefore is underknown the degree of international coordination that was happening. There were FSB meetings happening daily, some part of the FSB during the crisis that were important for different jurisdictions to know what was happening in different parts of the world and to understand the implications of decisions that were being made. Some of the highest profile decisions were decisions like the suspension of dividends and how would different jurisdictions handle that and what would the implications be if jurisdictions handled it differently. But there were, limitlessly complex raft of additional questions that were being coordinated through the mechanism of the FSB during the most intense months of COVID in the spring and early summer of 2020. And then taking off after that, very importantly, the FSB having focused on the fact that the banking system actually performed quite well during the COVID shock, but that the non-bank system didn't and nearly brought things down. We pivoted to an intense focus on kind of the key unaddressed issues in non-bank finance and the sort of the development of working practices through the FSB over the previous decade. One of the reasons that those non-bank finance issues hadn't been addressed in the early years after 2008-2009 was a little bit of a defensive posture of the non-bank regulators who believed that in the FSB process, in the global coordination process generally, they were the weak sisters. The central banks dominated. The central banks didn't understand their particular issues, didn't understand them well. They were seeking to clone banking regulation for a part of the financial system that really operates in a much more fragmented and different way than the banking system. So we put together a steering process within the FSB that was much more evenly balanced between, central banks and finance ministries on the one side and the non-bank regulators around the world on the other. And that decade of getting to know each other plus the creation of a more evenly balanced steering mechanism for non-bank financial issues has allowed the FSB to make some genuine progress, I think, since picking up that torch in the summer of 2020. And there is more that's on the way. That was unfinished business at the end of my term. But the process was clearly laid out, very well committed to by all the participants in the FSB, very high level participation, from all the relevant jurisdictions on the issues. So I'm really quite, hopeful that there will be some, consequential and positive outcomes from the FSB process.
Great. One last broad philosophical question. For now, there's always worries about fiscal dominance pressuring central banks. The Fed is focused in part these days on climate and inequality, which some say is beyond its mandate. You get blamed for inflation when inflation can have to do with fiscal or policy supply chain issues. The Fed isn't independent in the sense that board members are nominated, approved by Congress, the chair testifies, dual mandate comes from Congress, etc. But you do have the instrument independence, as I call it. Do you worry about the Fed being able to preserve its future independence and, to put it amusingly, is Jay Powell woke?
So there are a whole complex of, you know, a whole range, I guess I should say, of questions that people are eager to have the Fed engage on. That I think, but the issues surrounding them are slightly different. So take, for example, climate change. And as I'm fond of saying, you know, notwithstanding my Republican credentials, I drive an electric car. I live in a solar powered house. I think that, you know, those are important issues for society to be thinking about. And I think that that's actually a pretty routine and normal issue for the Fed to include in the risks that it supervises banks for. As it thinks about what risks might face the financial system, it should include that. It should include climate change, among many others. Now, the question is, if you, including that, if you do a dispassionate analysis of the risk of climate change to the financial system, what conclusion do you come to? I mean, given the geological time over which climate change evolves and the relatively short nature of exposures of the financial system to the real economy, it's highly unlikely that the evolution of climate is going to pose serious financial risks to our financial system, that the evolution of climate itself. A higher risk that political decisions that might be taken to address the evolution of climate over time could have a more accelerated and disruptive consequence for the financial system. Now, you know, one might say, well, if the biggest economic risk from climate change is the risk of kind of unintended consequences of precipitate political action, maybe we shouldn't take that action if that's the biggest risk, if you're doing a dispassionate analysis of this issue. But putting that issue on the Fed agenda, I think is pretty routine, as long as we approach it in a dispassionate analytical fashion, which is not going to result, given the nature of the issue, in dramatic changes in what we're asking the banks to do. Again, so just a somewhat further example, I live in Salt Lake City. The skiing industry is very important here. Obviously, climate change is a threat to that industry over a long period of time. But banks that are financing ski resorts extend those loans for a few years. And over the course of a few years, the, you know, climate change is not going to make any particular difference, to the operation of the ski resort. Over the course of a few decades, it might, and certainly over the course of a century, it might, but no bank is lending to a ski resort for a century. And as the, you know, and as the performance of a ski resort changes in light of the evolution of climate in the state of Utah over the course of the next decades, banks will change how it is that they lend to them. They'll do that fairly naturally, and the, our supervisory system can ensure that they're taking account of those risks. So that's kind of those climate change issues, totally appropriate as long as we approach the analysis dispassionately. It's just another risk. The equity issues, I think, are, I mean, we do take those into account. We have to understand that our tools are limited as to how we address them. But again, it's not inappropriate for us to have them on the list of issues that we think about. The change in the monetary policy framework of the Federal Reserve, again, over the over the course of my time there, and Rich and Jay, you know, really led that process. I viewed that as essentially, you can view that as, we will tolerate a lower unemployment rate than we might have in the past, with risks to somewhat higher inflation for a period because of the benefits to the economy And it's not irrelevant, the benefits to society that come from a lower unemployment rate and the engagement of people into the workforce, cohorts of the populace who were less tied to the workforce before when you have a higher unemployment rate. Those cohorts tend to be disproportionately minorities. And that's a real benefit. That's a benefit to the economy. That's a benefit to society. We think about that. But in the language of the woke, if you will, we don't center the benefits to minorities in the answer in setting policy. We say we can and should allow the unemployment rate to fall to lower levels than in the past. We can tolerate that. The amount of inflation that will ensue from that element of the framework will be tolerable. And the benefits will be great. They will disproportionately accrue to minorities, but they will accrue broadly to everyone and to the society. So I think that a lot of these issues that are being raised, they raise red flags for certain parts of the political spectrum. I think they're perfectly appropriate for the Fed to be thinking about, provided that again, one thinks about them analytically and not politically.
Great. Okay. Well, let us move on. I've invited Patricia Mosser and Don Cohn to be two leadoff discussants, since they know this terrain far better than I ever dreamt of doing. So, Trish, would you like to briefly lead us off with a provocative question for Randy?
Sure, I'd be happy to. Thank you, Mark, for inviting me. It's a real pleasure to have a chance to quiz Randy at least a little bit about all the incredibly important issues that he worked on during his term as vice chair. So my questions are about the Fed's emergency lending authorities. They're sort of a parallel set, and at least in my view, of unfinished business to some of the regulatory and financial stability issues. Let me start by saying that I agree completely with the comments that were in your December speech about the new credit lending programs that were done by the Fed during COVID. They were A, necessary, and B, quasi-fiscal and policy. And so they set a precedent, particularly a governance precedent, that needs to be managed really carefully in the future. And I actually thought your idea of that you proposed in the speech, that figuring out a way to just get them out of the Fed's balance sheet and back to the fiscal authorities as soon as possible was actually a handoff, if you like, is actually quite a good idea. But my questions are actually about your views about more traditional lender of last resort and liquidity provision. In the last two crises, both COVID and the financial crisis, it seems pretty clear, at least to me, and I think to quite a few number of former central bankers, that the Fed's framework for lender of last resort is, frankly, not really up to snuff. First of all, the Fed's only standing domestic facility, the window, is not very effective for a couple of reasons. First of all, long-standing stigma, heavily stigmatized, which I know you have views on and took a few steps to address, and I'd be interested in hearing about that. But perhaps more importantly, it's only available to a third of the financial system. And so the result of that is, which is related to my second question, is that the other two thirds of the financial system to get access to lender of last resort, so the non-bank financial institutions, exactly the same set where the regulatory perimeter is a lot fuzzier, that requires emergency authorities, and so the Fed can't use those to prevent a run or a panic. They can only institute them once the run and the panic have already started. So the building's kind of got to be half burned down before you get to call in the fire department. So I'd be very interested in hearing your views about, you know, what can should be done. What's the unfinished business that you think are sort of most important in both ones, both sort of the more traditional lending as well as 13-3, to use the shorthand.
So on the more traditional lending, I completely agree with the point. I mean, if you think, if you were creating the Federal Reserve today instead of in 1913, it would never occur to you that the Federal Reserve would essentially be, the central flywheel for the banking system. It would be for the financial system, and you would, and the members of the Federal Reserve would not only be banks, they would be a much broader range of financial firms. And much of the emergency response of the Fed, both in 2008 and 2009 and during COVID, were jury-rigged. We now have templates as to how to address them, but they were kind of jury-rigged responses to the fact that that really is the Fed's role, is to provide liquidity to the financial system, and you have to figure out a way to do that when the formal participants are only the banks. And as you noted, a consequence of that is that the moral hazard of providing that liquidity support and serving as that flywheel to the non-bank system is higher because you don't regulate that system from a prudential point of view. The provider of liquidity doesn't regulate that system from a prudential point of view during non-stress times. Now, one way to address that, which I am very open to, and we've had discussions about, and that I think the law provides a significant amount of flexibility for us to do, is to formally have more accounts at the Fed for non-bank entities. Now, the staff at the Fed is very, very cautious and conservative when it comes to thinking about how one would do that. And there are, but the senior governance of the Fed is sort of much more open, I believe. And certainly I was very open to the notion that we should, allow a lot more people to the party. And one of the consequences of allowing more, a broader range of financial firms to have accounts at the Federal Reserve is that the conditions to those accounts could, if not be a kind of perfect regulatory system, you could impose some important regulation on entities that now do want accounts at the Federal Reserve, as a cost of doing business. The law doesn't require it, but you say, look, you want an account? We'll give you an account. Here are the terms. So I think that there should be some real thought given to expanding the scope of the Fed in that fashion, precisely because the role that it has to play in a time of crisis, the role that you would automatically create it to play if you were recreating it today, requires a much broader range of institutions to be integrated into the system.
Great. Don, please.
Hi, Randy. I would say let me underline Mark's comments about a long, distinguished career. Randy, I think you and I intersected in a couple of different Bush administrations.
Yes.
Even though I never got to work for you, I worked with you. And I think we've just seen demonstrated, or you've just nicely illustrated Mark's point about a thoughtful public servant. So it's great. Congratulations on your career. I actually want to drill down on two separate issues, abuse my privilege here. One is you highlighted non-bank financial institutions and non-bank finance markets. Probably the foundational market for the global financial system, certainly the U.S. and maybe the global U.S. Treasury securities market. And it broke badly in March of 2020. Now, one could argue that a once a century pandemic market can't actually be expected to be resilient to that without some help from the government. And I agree, but I think it also revealed weaknesses that had been there all along about the provision of liquidity. The observers have made really, I guess, three or four different suggestions to help this market be more resilient. One has to do with the leverage ratio, the bank leverage ratio, which is risk insensitive. And when it threatens to become binding, banks and dealers draw back from making markets and treasuries. And I know you've made some suggestions about reducing that leverage ratio. Maybe you should make some comments on that. But the second one is a repo facility at the Federal Reserve. That's a standing repo facility. The Federal Reserve has created such a facility while you were there. I think outside observers, such as the task force I was on and a group of G30 task force also, suggested that there be such a facility, but it be more widely available to some of these. So I wonder if you'd comment on whether the Fed's facility as it is enough. The third thing is central clearing for more mandated central clearing, so which would help manage risk and result in netting and save capital that way. And the other thing is data collection and transparency about that data. So your view of whether the authorities are on the right track and what additional steps need to make to shore up this very, very important, very, very important market. And then the second point I want to sneak in here is the countercyclical capital buffer, which you and I have discussed before. I think I worry that although the banks prove to be very well capitalized, the system we have in place now, including tying the stress test to the capital buffer, is potentially pro-cyclical. And in fact, the memo that you got from the staff when you put the stress capital buffer in did say it would probably be pro-cyclical the way it was being addressed. And you've made a suggestion to average the stress tests over 3 years, which would even any incipient countercyclicality would be damped by that. So I think the cure for that is a countercyclical capital buffer that's on in normal times and can be lowered under stress. I'd love to hear your thoughts about why you didn't get that accomplished in your 4 years at the Federal Reserve, and whether in fact you think it's a good idea to have a more actively managed countercyclical buffer as we did at the Bank of England.
Great. And I recall conversations at the Treasury, if we're going to put our eggs into the capital basket, we better put them in getting capital high rather than a countercyclical buffer. But that's was a Treasury view way back when. Randy.
So the Treasury market. So I got into a little bit of trouble by suggesting, I think, in the late spring of 2020, that, you know, that the Treasury market, I mean, it's dramatically larger than it was just a relatively short time ago. And it's not, I think it's a question we need to think about, as to whether it has for at least some period outstripped the ability of the private sector infrastructure to basically intermediate a market that's just that much bigger. It happens so quickly, and the private sector making decisions as to how to allocate capital in order to increase the infrastructure around that the dramatic increase in the size of the market is probably going to lag. And I think, you know, that's part of what we saw during March of 2020. Now, you know, what is the answer to that? I think that we have to try to ensure that that unnecessary obstacles that we put to private sector intermediation of the system are as limited as possible. The leverage ratio that you indicated, I think is one. It's not certainly not the only cause of the dysfunction that we saw in 2020. And as you indicated at the outset of your question, Don, I don't think we can or should solve for March of 2020 not to have been a big disruption. There is no way you can structure a market that if everyone is selling and there are no buyers, you can't structure a market that market, that it will clear. You know, there's just no way you can, you know, create a system that can clear if there are only sellers and no buyers, as there were for several days in late March of 2020. The only thing that can happen is that you have an element of the system, the Federal Reserve, that can come in and act as the buyer for at least some period. But, you know, the leverage ratio has acted as an obstacle to intermediation. It did act as an obstacle to intermediation in March of 2020. A different aspect of how we regulate leverage leverage and liquidity, I guess, in the system caused the disruption or was a material element of the disruption of September of 2019. So I do think we need to look honestly at the calibration of some of these capital requirements and liquidity requirements and the effect that they have on the operation of markets. And anytime one proposes a change, particularly to the leverage ratio, I still don't quite understand why this is, but there is a vehement political response to saying, you know, we should, you know, mildly recalibrate the leverage ratio. I proposed during the crisis, I mean, the chairman of the Senate Banking Committee asked, is there anything that would be useful for us to, you know, additional steps that would be useful for us to do? And I said, well, if we had the ability in a crisis to temporarily adjust the leverage ratio, that would be useful because that would have been useful in dealing with the treasury market. We were running into issues with the banking system, having to shed deposits because of the leverage ratio. And I said that to him, and literally 15 minutes later, there was kind of a very personal, vituperative attack about my, you know, outrageous proposals to expose the soft white underbelly of the financial system. So that's hard to deal with, but I think we have to deal with it. If you look at, so our enhanced supplemental leverage ratio, the additional leverage requirements that we put on the largest firms, which is firms most important for the intermediation in the treasury market, we calibrated that in 2014. So this was before my time. But there was concern among a kind of a broad range of the board. That was a largely Obama-appointed board, and concern among a large portion of the board that calibration was going to be too tight, that we had basically, we were requiring too much leverage given, particularly given the amount of reserves in the banking system at the time. And the staff said, maybe it's a little too tight now, but the reserves in the banking system are going down, and we project that in December of 2021, they will be at $25 billion. Which when you look back to the pre-2008 Fed, that's not a crazy projection. It's kind of a little small even then, but not a crazy projection. But at the end of December of 2021, actual reserves in the system were about $4.5 trillion. So 135 times what the projection was when the enhanced supplemental leverage ratio was, or the supplemental leverage ratio was calibrated in 2014. We just have to fix that. We'll have to do that in the face of some, as I say, sometimes quite inexplicable political opposition. Move to your question about the countercyclical capital buffer. I actually really like your idea, what the UK has done, of having a sort of flexible layer of capital at the top of the capital stack that could be turned down. And I advocated for that in the US system. Indeed, I think it was a case of, Leibniz and Newton coming to the calculus at the same time. But I raised the issue in a discussion with Mark Carney once. He said, yeah, we're thinking about the same thing, that my concern about the countercyclical capital buffer in the United States has been that with where we calibrated a number of the elements of our capital system, we calibrated them above the international minimums for good and solid reasons, but effectively our capital levels are materially higher than the capital levels of banks in other parts of the world, even in the UK, although the UK does a pretty good job, materially higher than in Europe or in Japan. That affects the international competitiveness of the system, but it also affects the efficiency of our own system simply for providing support to the domestic economy. If in order to have the countercyclical approach that we think would be good, we were adding capital onto that so that we could turn it down, I think we'd just have too much capital given where we calibrated our system. So, and this is part of what the UK did, obviously, as you know, Don. The UK took a portion of their kind of permanent capital and converted it into, a portion of that flexible layer at the top was turning what had been through the cycle requirements into variable requirements at the top. And I argued that we should do that, for our system, that we should take a portion of the gold plating that we had at the top, keep it there, but make it variable so that it was automatically turned downable in the event of a crisis. And, you know, and I had said in the 3 years leading up to COVID, our problem was not going to be that we didn't have enough capital come the next shock, because we hadn't turned on the countercyclical capital buffer. Our problem would be that we had turned it on through the gold plating and had no way to turn it down effectively. We had to do all of these sort of emergency actions that were politically controversial because they hadn't been, the groundwork hadn't been laid by making them formally part of the system. So, so I actually am very much in favor of having a flexible layer of capital at the top of the stack. I just think we need to get there by taking a portion of our current through the cycle capital requirements and making them that flexible cushion so that our capital requirements stay the same, but that top layer is variable.
Well, great. All right. Well, we are running out of time, so maybe we can move to a few lightning round questions. Christopher Smart and John Valis are going to join us. Christopher, can you kick us off with lightning round questions?
I'd be happy to. First, I wanted to say I'm happy to be with you. I thought I was the only person that Mark had taught that coordination is what you do to the other guy. But it's a lesson that I have continued to carry throughout my career. Mark, because our time is so short, asked me to make my question as concise as possible. So the most concise version of my question is cryptocurrencies, ? A more focused version would be, given how quickly this space is moving, how can the Fed possibly be patient and come up with the right design for digital currency when the rest of the world is moving ahead so quickly? And by the time the Fed or U.S. regulators generally come up with a basically good design for a central bank digital currency, the world will have overtaken them.
So, I will. So, lightning round answer, although I could talk for an hour on that too. So I think that the right answer for the United States is that we shouldn't be designing the digital currency. We should leave that to the private sector. We have a pretty good framework in mind for what the regulatory issues that are posed by sort of private stable coins are. We worked through that in great detail, a lot of different issues, working with DM, nay Libra, for 2 years on, you know, what are our concerns, you know, what's the right regulatory framework. That regulatory framework is largely in place. I think the PWG paper that came out on stable coins reflects it. I think it's a little overly conservative, but not crazily so. So, you know, I think that's the answer, which is that I think we can very quickly implement the right regulatory framework for the development of private sector stablecoins and let the private sector world innovate at the speed that it can. With respect to CBDCs, I think that the risks to the financial system, to the Fed, of a CBDC are just too great, and they are unnecessary. If you've got the private sector developing this advanced technological money, almost all of our money currently is digital. It's all also private. I mean, the only state money that we actually have are the pieces of paper in our pocket, and I usually don't have any in my pocket. So the private sector is changing the technology through which that digital private money is provided. And I think we should let them do it. I don't think that the central bank needs to. And so since this was supposed to be a lightning question, it's already gone on too long, I won't get into why.
Great. Thunder, too. John Valis.
Yes, my thunder was stolen by Donald Kahn when he asked about the SLR ratio and the efficiency of the treasury market. So I'm going to move somewhere where you haven't. First of all, thanks for having me. I'm going to move somewhere where you haven't gone to, which is monetary policy. And my lightning round question is quite simple. Will the Fed ever get to a positive real policy rate in this cycle? When you look at what the market's expecting, when you look at what the Fed thinks the neutral rate is, there's a massive 75, 80 basis points gap. Will we ever see positive real rates again in the U.S.?
Because we're running out of time, let me build on John's question since we want you to be provocative and conservative. Should they be raising in March 50 points, 25 points, quantitative tightening? Any lightning round thoughts on those as well to conclude on, in addition to John's comments?
Thank you.
So the short answer is yes. We will see positive real interest rates. I think we will see them sooner rather than later, because I think that's what will be required to get on top of inflation. And I think that the Fed is committed to getting on top of inflation. I think that I believe that part of the response ought to be, and therefore, because I think the Fed system is a good, it comes to sensible, good conclusions most of the time, I think it will be an acceleration of the withdrawal of accommodation. I think it will be moving in March on interest rates. Whether that will be 50 basis points or not, I think that would be kind of a shock. I think it's probably enough of a signal to send to accelerate sort of the ending of asset purchases and to begin raising interest rates in March, and the expectations will increase as one sees more SEPs going forward. The existing FOMC is quite committed. As I've said all along, people had different views as to what we were trying to do with the change in the monetary policy framework. My view was less about, there were certainly people on the FOMC who believed we were trying to fine-tune inflation expectations and increase them from 1.8 to 2.2 for some period of time. I don't think we can actually do any of that, let alone accurately measure much of that. But I do think that it was worthwhile. I viewed it as simply saying we will wait to see the whites of their eyes when faced with inflationary risks. We won't act precipitately. We will wait longer than we have in the past. But, as I've also said, we never said we'd let the army march over us. We said we would wait until we'd gotten all the benefit from a lower unemployment rate before we acted. We waited. The army is on top of us. The Fed will act, and it will be successful in containing inflation. So then the real risks are, well, what are the consequences of the fact that the Fed will do that? That's its job, but it will dramatically increase the cost of financing the federal government. The potential unintended consequences of a private economy that has grown used to very low interest rates for a long period of time, people need to be thinking about what those consequences are, but I don't think we need to worry that the Fed will stay behind the curve on inflation.
Well, great. We asked you questions you could have spent hours and hours upon. It was a good tour Tudor is on, I tremendously thank you and everybody for joining us today. I thank you for your public service. We've run out of time, so I can't tell Randy Quarles stories, unfortunately. But let me just thank all the audience. I apologize to the audience. I didn't get to many questions at all. But this is still fast-moving, stimulating conversation we've had today. So thank you, or should I say, to quote a Randy Quarles-ism in conclusion, torrential thanks to Randy Quarles.
Thank you for listening to the OMFIF podcast.